Hello and welcome to today's SNEB webinar, which is sponsored by the Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division and the Public Health Nutrition Division. I'm so glad you've joined us for today's presentation. My name is Nick Estrada and I am the Director of Membership for the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior. Before we begin, I would like to review a few pieces of information for you. If you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, you'll see a tab called Handouts. Here you'll find the a PDF of the slides for today. Feel free to download these and take notes as you follow along. We'll take questions at the end of the presentation, so feel free to type those in throughout the presentation, however, and our moderator will share those with our presenter at the end. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short 5-question survey. Please do take a moment to complete this as your feedback is greatly appreciated, both of SNEB and our presenter. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent by the end of the day on Tuesday that will include a link to the recording for today's session, the slide handouts, and the CEU certificate for your attendance today. I'd now like to turn it over to our moderator for the day, Dan Remley of Ohio State University Extension, who serves as an assistant professor and field specialist in food nutrition and wellness. Dan?
Good afternoon on the East Coast. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kales, our speaker for today. Dr. Kales is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and professor and director of the Occupational Medicine Residency at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's the co-director and co-founder of the Initiative for Productivity and Health Management, which organized and hosted the groundbreaking 2014 Mediterranean Diet and Workplace Health Conference. And he was the scientific chair of the landmark 2017 Mediterranean Diet and Health Conference in Greece. Dr. Kales is also the chief occupational environmental medicine and medical director for employee health at the Cambridge Health Alliance, a Harvard-affiliated hospital system. Dr. Kales has participated in a wide range of medical and public health research, advisory, and teaching activities on 5 continents, resulting in over 150 publications and wide recognition nationally and internationally. He serves on the editorial boards of several biomedical journals and is a faculty member in Harvard's Cardiovascular Epidemiology Program, a multidisciplinary heart disease prevention collaborative, and Harvard Medical School's Division of Sleep Medicine. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Kales.
Thank you very much. Good morning on the West Coast, good afternoon on the East Coast, and everything in between. It's really a pleasure and honor to be here. I want to thank the Society for Nutrition, Education, and Behavior for the opportunity. The title of today's presentation is Survival Mediterranean Style, a cluster randomized trial in the United States Fire Service. And our learning objectives are basically broken down here into 3. First, I want to review for you the chronic disease risks of firefighting, particularly cardiovascular disease and cancer. This is something that our group has been working on with firefighters for the past 25 years or so. Second, I want to just speak in background terms about Mediterranean diet, nutrition, what it is, and the health benefits therefrom. And then third, review the trial of trying to implement Mediterranean diet into the United States Fire Service and the Indianapolis Fire Department, and some of the preliminary results we have to date. So let's talk first about firefighting. So everybody knows firefighting is a dangerous job. I think that's obvious to just about anyone who watches TV, reads the newspaper. And in fact, in the United States, there are about 80 to 100 deaths in the course of firefighting duty that occur to the U.S. Fire Service, those both career and volunteer firefighters throughout the country. And every year, the federal government and the United States Fire Service, they report on these statistics. And while they've fallen somewhat from the 70s and 80s, from maybe 150 per year to about 100, they've stayed steady at around 100 a year. But what you see here now in this pie chart is something that may surprise some of you. The majority of the firefighters who have fatalities on duty are passing away from sudden cardiac death and other cardiovascular causes like strokes and aneurysms. So smoke inhalation or asphyxiation from smoke inhalation and burns actually are causing a minority of the deaths. And you see here statistics for 2015. But if we look at the next slide here, the current image that's up, we can see that sudden cardiac death far and away dwarfs both asphyxiation and burns on year in and year out. And here you see statistics for roughly 25 years. So let's try to look at it and see why heart disease is such an important cause of on-duty fatalities. So there is a concept in cardiovascular epidemiology that physically demanding and psychologically stressful work or activities or combinations thereof can, quote, trigger or precipitate heart attacks or sudden cardiac death in vulnerable persons. Those are persons generally with underlying heart disease. So let's look at what firefighters do when they're fighting a fire. It is strenuous work, and it combines aspects of both static or, let's say, weightlifting type of exercise, as well as aerobic type of exercise. So it's something like chopping wood or shoveling snow or a combination of all of both of those, as well as climbing stairs. Moreover, this work is done wearing very, very heavy PPE or personal protective equipment. The typical firefighter wears over 40 pounds of gear and may have another 5 to 15 pounds of tools that they're carrying along with that. Not only is the personal protective gear, the turnout gear, heavy, but it is insulating. Therefore, in the hot environment of a fire or even in summertime, when a firefighter is engaging in this type of heavy work, they are unable to get rid of heat the same way you would if you were working out in the gym and wearing light clothing. So a lot of that heat is unable to escape because basically the firefighter is encapsulated inside their gear. And third, the environment in which firefighters work when they face a fire is hot, dangerous, and chaotic. So there is a really, really huge adrenaline surge that is on board from the moment that the alarm bell rings. Firefighters' heart rates shoot from resting to near maximal heart rates, and they can remain at maximal, near maximal heart rates, even super maximal heart rates, for long, prolonged periods thereafter. Having said all that, you can see here in the next image why, when a firefighter is in full turnout gear and in a hot environment and fully engaged in a fire, every single system and organ in the body is challenged in some way. But in particular, these challenges are particularly pronounced for the cardiovascular system. And if we break this down, and these series of slides that you're looking at here come from a colleague of mine at Skidmore College, Dr. Denise Smith, who's a physiologist who has extensively studied firefighters under situations of simulated fires with full monitoring and taking frequent blood samples, et cetera, and using ultrasound and other techniques. And you can see in terms of the cardiovascular system, every single aspect, both the heart, the blood vessels, as well as the blood itself and the coagulatory system, are all challenged by the strain of firefighting. So in general, there is an increase in heart rate, an increase in blood pressure. There is an increase in the stiffness and the contraction and flow going on within the vasculature. And there is a relative thickening, dehydration, and increase in platelets and increase in coagulatory parameters such that blood clotting is more is quicker and the blood is more prone to clot. And we've published over a number of years a number of papers, just showing you a few, looking at all of these phenomena in terms of the epidemiology. But what we come down to is really a model of triggering or precipitation by stressful duties. And what you can see here is that the important thing is that for these to precipitate or trigger a sudden cardiac death or other cardiovascular event, the firefighter has to have a substrate of vulnerability. And generally, this comes in two forms that are often coexisting. One is the typical hardening of the coronary arteries, those blood vessels which supply the heart. So coronary atherosclerotic disease or coronary stenosis or coronary heart disease. And here you see buildup of plaque within a hypothetical coronary artery here. But also an enlargement of the heart over time due to obesity, due to high blood pressure and other factors, with thickened heart muscle, particularly the left ventricle. This thickened heart is more prone to arrhythmias and less flexible and has less room to pump blood with. This sets up a situation that under stress, this type of vulnerable heart is susceptible to either arrhythmia or an infarct, either of which or in combination could cause sudden cardiac death or another cardiac event. So the main thing here is, by lifestyle, we're never going to take away the stress or the strain of this job, but we can reduce the likelihood that someone is a vulnerable firefighter, or in a vulnerable firefighter, we can even reduce their susceptibility through decreasing inflammation and other parameters with diet and lifestyle. And again, one of the big implications for prevention is having to do with the obesity epidemic. And it turns out that currently 33% to 40% of the United States Fire Service are obese, and a combined 75% to 80% are overweight or obese. So a minority of firefighters, even though we think of it as a physical job, only a minority are at an ideal or normal body mass index. And this is not just because of misrepresenting muscle mass as fat. There are a few firefighters who are bodybuilder types or linebacker types that have an overweight BMI due mainly to muscular mass. But if we use measures of body fat either directly or estimating body fat such as bioelectrical impedance, we find that even more firefighters are obese than when we do it by BMI. So there are more false negatives than there are false positives with BMI. A second major health problem and concern of firefighters is that their work exposes them to multiple carcinogens. So as you can imagine, anytime you're around burning objects and combustion, especially nowadays when we have more and more synthetic furniture and synthetic materials used in buildings, many carcinogens are generated and they're present in the atmosphere. And although firefighters wear self-contained breathing apparatus during firefighting, they often remove these during the phase known as overhaul, where they're looking for smoldering things and putting out the last objects, or they're in close proximity to fire, or simply these chemicals have gotten on the turnout gear, and in the past, firefighters were not changing the gear or washing themselves carefully after a firefighter. So exposure to carcinogens is well documented. Moreover, epidemiologic studies have documented through a variety of means, individual studies, cohort studies, meta-analyses, et cetera, that firefighting does or is associated with a statistically significant increase in the risk of cancer. In particular, a study done through the offices of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, the largest study ever done retrospectively, looking at firefighters from 1950 all the way through 2009 in multiple U.S. cities, established that there was roughly a 10 to 15% increase across all cancers for cancer incidence and cancer mortality among firefighters compared to the general population. So at this point, we accept the conclusion that there is evidence of a relationship between firefighting and cancer. Just like cardiovascular disease, however, lifestyle also plays a big role in cancer. So body composition, diet, exercise are all important. And you can see here that actually the this is a summary slide from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. The risk of cancer associated with obesity is generally 30 to 80%. And in some cases, such as esophageal cancer, you have a fivefold risk associated with obesity. So this is actually a much greater risk than the risk from carcinogens in firefighting. Now, it's not to say that firefighters should not be concerned about those carcinogens, nor that they should take, they should not take measures to protect themselves from those carcinogens. However, obviously, firefighters can gain just as much or more by protecting themselves from the effects of obesity. What are some of the causes of the high obesity prevalence in U.S. firefighters? Here on the left, we just see some of the documentation over time from the 1980s through 2005. We can see that firefighters of all ages, including recruits, the average BMI has increased drastically over the last decades. Some of the factors include shift work, which produces disturbances in both sleep and eating patterns, which are obesogenic or increase the propensity towards overweight, metabolic syndrome, and obesity. We see unreliable mean times. When you're on the fly, it's kind of hard to eat a salad on the run or when you're driving, but it's easy to eat a burger with one hand and hold the steering wheel with another. And interestingly, in surveys and cross-sectional research, when we compared obese and non-obese firefighters, the two individual factors, of course, if we looked at across their diets globally, there are major differences in the global diet scores. However, the two individual items that statistically differ between these groups is that obese firefighters have a much higher intake of sugary drinks and fast food. So these are really no-brainers, but it's easier to change these, easier said than done to change them. Of course, firefighters are not the only ones who have this problem. These are slides from the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Martinez Gonzalez, who's a visiting professor here at Harvard and is also at the University of Navarra in Spain. We can see globally that there is a strong trend for increasing obesity worldwide. Furthermore, in another slide from the same investigator, we can see that the worldwide burden of both cardiovascular diseases up here in the darker orange and cancers in the darker yellow and diabetes here in the blue are really driven by overweight and obesity. Not to say that normal weight persons do not have a risk for these diseases, they do, but obviously the proportionate burden is much smaller than that seen in overweight and especially in over obese persons. So turning now to what interests all of us here today is how can we improve these things by diet. And this particular slide shows a model of mitigating and preventing heart disease using a Mediterranean diet intervention. But many of the same factors involving inflammation, obesity, and other factors also operate in terms of cancer, diabetes, and other chronic diseases. So we can see that Mediterranean nutrition and lifestyle with increased physical activity and healthy sleep do accomplish many things, such as increasing the body's sensitivity to insulin, improving the body's glucose metabolism, improving lipid metabolism, increasing the availability and activity of antioxidants, decreasing inflammation and blood clotting, improving the health and function of blood vessels, improving blood pressure, and of course, improving body composition. And so the main idea is to shift people away from these states of vulnerability or even intermediate risk factor states of obesity, metabolic syndrome, et cetera, diabetes. So having covered the health risks of firefighters and some of the opportunities with diet, let's start to take a look at understanding Mediterranean nutrition or diet and some of its benefits. So the term Mediterranean diet, although this has existed for millennia in the area of the Mediterranean where olive trees grow naturally and then were eventually cultivated by first the Cretans and then other societies around the Mediterranean, hence making olives, table olives and olive oil available as a food. The actual term Mediterranean diet is something new coming from the 1950s and 60s and the American nutritionist Ansel Keys. He was intrigued visiting southern Italy, speaking with a cardiologist, learning that in the 1950s, there was very little cardiovascular disease at that time in the city of Naples or in the region of southern Italy. And he was determined to look at the underlying diet and physical activity and lifestyle of the people. He figured that it must have something to do with that. And hence, he started something called the Seven Country Study to try to further delineate this. But let's look, before we look at the seven country study, let's just take a look at the definition. So eating habits historically followed around countries bordering the Mediterranean Sea. However, not all Mediterranean diets are equal. This is really much more about the diets of southern Italy and Greece, particularly Crete, or areas of blue zones such as Icaria in Greece and Sardinia in Italy. And the modern example of the PREDIMED study many of you have read about. It involves a high intake of extra virgin olive oil. In fact, in Crete, during the 1950s and 60s, the population that rurally derived 40% of their calories from olive oil. 40% of their calories from fat, but a healthy fat. High consumption of fruits, vegetables, other plant proteins, and fibers, including nuts and legumes. Unrefined whole grains and fish, moderate intake of dairy, particularly fermented cheeses and yogurt, eggs and lean meats, moderate alcohol intake with meals, usually in the form of wine, and a much lower but not abstention from red meat and sweets. Here we'll just take a quick look at a couple slides from Key's famous seven country studies. So he enrolled populations from Greece in Corfu or Kerkira and also Crete, several populations in Italy and Yugoslavia, two populations in Japan, and then several more northern European Western diets, including the United States, Eastern and Western Finland, and Holland. And here we see a chart plotting the 10-year incidence of heart disease. You can see it's highest in East Finland versus the percent of dietary calories that come from total fat. And you can see what we were saying before, Crete, although it had one of the lowest rates of heart disease, they had one of the highest fat consumptions. Whereas Japan had a very low fat consumption and also low heart disease rate. And Finland had high fat consumption and high heart disease rate. The difference here is the type of fat. If we look at the next slide, this is now 25-year mortality rate from coronary heart disease. And we see Eastern Finland, Western Finland, the Netherlands, and the United States coming in first place in terms of the highest rates of heart disease and having the highest intakes of saturated fat. We can see the Italian populations in here, not in the farthest south Italy, but more near Rome and a little bit south of there, and sort of intermediate in terms of having a lower saturated fat intake and about half the heart disease rate of Northern Europe and the U.S. And here we see Crete, Dalmatia, which is in Yugoslavia, but very similar on the coast of the Adriatic, very similar diet to the Greek diet with lots of olive oil, fruits, fish, and vegetables. And G here is Corfu, another island in Greece. So we see low intakes of saturated fat and low intakes of heart disease. If Let's look at one more historical slide. This is from Professor Willett, a professor of nutrition at our school, something he published in Science back in the 90s, and looking at life expectancy and disease rates based on 1980 statistics. And we can see, even compared to Japan, which has a known for a healthy diet, Greeks at that time had a longer life expectancy, pretty much equivalent, much lower than the U.S., but equivalent to Japan, risk of coronary heart disease, much lower risk of stroke than Japan because of the high salt intake. And we can see a lower cancer risk than both. So in many ways, what Professor Willett was arguing here is that even though the Asian diet is quite healthy, the Mediterranean diet was superior. What about experimental trials? One of the first randomized controlled trials was something called the Lyon Heart Disease Study. This took French men who had already suffered a heart attack or other form of coronary artery disease and randomized them to a Mediterranean diet-based intervention versus a usual care or controlled diet. And we're looking here at Kaplan-Meier survival curves. And we can see that the control group was dying or having secondary heart disease events at a much higher rate. At the end of 5 years, about 15% of the group had had a second event, whereas only 5% of the experimental group had had another event. And this trial was stopped early due to the statistically significant difference between the intervention and the controls, and it was felt to be unethical to continue the study because the nutrition intervention was so favorable. This is another randomized trial done in Italy looking at metabolic syndrome. So all, again, it's a secondary prevention effort. All of the subjects had metabolic syndrome. Half were randomized to Mediterranean diet, half were randomized to a controlled diet. And you can see that at the end of the study, more than 50% of those in the Mediterranean diet group had resolved their metabolic syndrome, whereas only about 10 to 15% of the controls had resolved their metabolic syndrome. And finally, here, the PREDIMED study. Here we can see this is not a Kaplan-Meier survival curve, but this is a curve of cumulative incidence of myocardial infarction, stroke, or death from cardiovascular disease. So the higher and steeper the curve, the worse. Here's the control group, and these are the two Mediterranean diet interventions. In orange, Mediterranean diet with nuts, and in green, Mediterranean diet supplemented with extra virgin olive oil. What they did in this study, this was the first randomized controlled trial of primary prevention, and all of the subjects here were middle-aged persons, men and women, with diabetes and multiple other or other combinations of multiple cardiovascular risk factors, but not known heart disease. And basically the outcome was a first-time new onset incidence of death from cardiovascular disease or new onset heart disease. And we can see this trial was also stopped early due to the more favorable outcome, about a 30% decrease in the incidence rates for the Mediterranean diet treated groups. One more slide from PREDIMED, and this simply looks at the amount of weight loss in the three groups over 5 years of the study, simply to point out that while all three groups lost a modest amount of weight, about 1 kilogram over 5 years, so about 2.2 pounds over or less over a period of 5 years, so very, very slight, the dramatic effects that we saw on the last slide and were also shown for diabetes, metabolic syndrome, breast cancer, cognitive decline, and many other outcomes are not due to changes in weight, but due to changes in metabolic risk, primarily mediated probably through changes in inflammation. What about Mediterranean diet and cancer? A number of meta-analyses have been performed, and generally they show decreases in many types of cancer when we look at those subjects who enjoyed the highest levels of compliance or adherence with a Mediterranean diet versus those who comply poorly with a Mediterranean diet. So in summary, what are some of the health benefits we observe in both observational and clinical trials? Roughly 30% reductions in heart disease morbidity and mortality, 25 to 30% reductions in the risk of diabetes mellitus, up to 40% reductions in measures of body composition and risk for adverse measures, I should say, 30 to 40% reduction in the risk of metabolic syndrome, 20 to 30% decrease in the risk of various types of cancer, death from those types of cancer, and overall, 15 to 25% decrease in the risk of death from all causes. There's actually more. So here we're looking at a meta-analysis of Mediterranean diet and the incidence of depression. We can see that most of the individual studies are to the left of the 1.0 line, so they show a reduction. And we can see the summary estimate here shows an overall odds ratio of 0.068, so about a 30% reduction in the risk of depression. Here's another study looking also meta-analysis, I believe, looking at cumulative survival as it regards Alzheimer's dementia. And we can see that the group with up here, the darkest line with the highest compliance for Mediterranean diet has the longest survival free of dementia, whereas the low compliance group has the worst survival in terms of dementia-free years. So again, looking just at clinical trials, we can see again heart disease, diabetes, breast cancer prevention from PREDIMED, multiple outcomes in terms of intermediate markers, improved cognition with less decline and less incidence of dementia, lower incidence of depression, better long-term efficacy for weight loss. We didn't look at studies here, individual ones, but they do exist. Better sleep, and even improved sexual function. Based on that, 3 years ago, the government advisory board that came up with USDA dietary guidelines did recognize and recommend Mediterranean diet as a healthy option for Americans. And frankly, the other two options they recommended are not that different. They just don't specifically recommend olive oil or in the case of a vegetarian diet, obviously they exclude meat. If we look at the 2018 report from U.S. News and World Report, where they categorize all the top scientifically evaluated as well as commercial diets, and this is a panel of a wide variety of highly qualified experts in various fields that all relate to diet and their disease. You can see here across multiple measures, best overall diet, best diet for healthy eating, best healthy heart diet, easiest to follow, plant-based and diabetes diet. Mediterranean diet was either number one or number two across the board. And most importantly, I think for me, it came in first in terms of easiest to follow. We can have a lot of great diets, but if they're not followed, they're no good. Before we turn to the trial, let's just look at some preliminary evidence that we have in firefighters that helped us justify the grant funding for the project I'm going to talk to you about. this is from a study we published in the journal Plus One, and it was a cross-sectional study of exercise capacity, exercise habits, and other things on cardiovascular risk factors. But we also had questions on nutrition along with this, even though it wasn't the primary purpose of the study. And what we did is we used the nutrition questions to create what we called a modified Mediterranean diet score. The lowest scores representing those firefighters with the lowest adherence to Mediterranean diet, the highest scores representing the highest adherence or highest compliance. Once we had calculated each firefighter's score, we divided the firefighter population up into quartiles. And when we compared the highest and lowest quartiles, again, we saw what was consistent with a lot of the data we just reviewed. A 35% decrease in the risk of metabolic syndrome between the highest and lowest compliance, a 40% lower risk of weight gain reported over the last 5 years, and in continuous associations, i.e. not looking at quartiles, but looking at the Mediterranean diet scores as a continuous variable, we saw consistent and statistically significant associations with improved or higher high-density lipoprotein, lower total cholesterol HDL ratios, lower body fat. And interestingly, these three measures remain significant after adjusting for important covariates such as age, body mass index, and physical activity levels. We had two more steps to accomplish in terms of preliminary data to make an argument to fund a trial in the U.S. Fire Service, and namely that was to show that in both career and volunteer firefighters, they would be willing to and acceptable and open to such an option. And when we surveyed these groups, it's not shown here, but a vast majority, about three quarters, were not satisfied with the nutrition information they were receiving from the fire service. And about the same proportion, about 75-80%, were interested in learning more. When we presented them in random order with descriptions of five popular diets, a Mediterranean, paleo, TLC, which is kind of like the American Heart Association, Old Diet, Atkins Diet, and Engine 2, which is a plant-based diet that was created by a former firefighter. We asked them for their ratings to put these in order from 1 to 5, 1 being their favorite, 5 being their less favorite. And here what we see in this graphic is we compared overall percentage of positive ratings, i.e. a number 1 or a number 2, versus minus the proportion of negative ratings, i.e. a number 4 or number 5 ranking. So we see here that overall, after excluding the negative ratings, Mediterranean diet still had about a 40% favorability rating, down from, 60%. The others went down in accordance, and we can see here that a totally plant-based diet was overwhelmingly rejected and would not be acceptable by the majority of firefighters. We can see overwhelmingly negative reactions here, or favorability ratings from the firefighters. So we're right on time with 20 minutes left to take a look at the trial, how it was constructed, and some of the preliminary results we have to date. So the formal title of our project is Feeding America's Bravest, / Survival Mediterranean Style. Here you see our study's logo. Our trial is registered with clinicaltrials.gov. And this is sort of the intro page to the participants' website, which I'll describe a little more in detail as we go along. And this is our grant support from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, or FEMA. The overall design of this project is that it is a randomized trial, but what we call a randomized cluster trial. What that means is that the unit of randomization is actually the firehouse and not the individual firefighter. That said, each individual firefighter must individually consent, yay or nay, on whether they will participate in the trial. So the unit of randomization is the firehouse. There are 44 firehouses in the IFD or Indianapolis Fire Department. 22 were randomized into the intervention group in phase one, and 22 firehouses were randomized into the control group. Once that was accomplished, individual firefighters in each of these 44 houses were approached, and approximately 400 firefighters consented, about 40% of the total membership of the fire department. So actually a very good rate of consent for an intervention trial. The total follow-up will be over 2 years, but I'm going to talk to you now about the first 12 months. So in the first 12 months, as I said, the firehouses were randomized either to intervention or control. Those firefighters in the intervention group were given access to the MDNI or Mediterranean Diet Nutritional Intervention. Those firefighters in the control firehouses simply received usual care, which means they got no specific advice or input about exercise or nutrition other than what they might get from their union or the fire department. So let me emphasize, this is not a feeding study. We know that if we simply substituted a Mediterranean diet for somebody's typical diet, we could improve their outcomes if we could control what they eat. But obviously our interest here is to see if we can change the behavior of free living subjects who have the freedom to eat whenever and whatever they want, by modifying the existing food culture based on the key principles of the Mediterranean diet. The main measure of effectiveness, it will be to look at the changes in the modified Mediterranean diet scale, which I mentioned, and I'll show you a little bit further, and looking at this in the field setting. What are the main components of the intervention? First of all, we have a partnership with Kroger Supermarkets, so every month, when the firefighters are in the intervention, they do have access for themselves and their families, both for use at the firehouse and at home, coupons and discounts, and I'll show you examples of these, for key Mediterranean foods. So in other words, they could buy anything they want at Kroger, but they're not going to get a discount for potato chips and Coca-Cola. However, they can get discounts for items such as olive oil, fruits, vegetables, beans, fish, lean proteins, etc. We also had generous donations from Barilla of Barilla Plus Pasta at the firehouses. This is a pasta that uses whole grains as well as chickpea and lentil flour. It's a higher protein, higher fiber, lower glycemic index than most pasta. And we've also had from multiple different friends and collaborators in Greece and in Spain, generous donations of olives and olive oil. We have had group sessions, both in person, I have to say not well attended, as well as videos, which I'll show you shortly, that are on the website that go over multiple principles of the diet. Written booklets were passed out at the time of consenting and are also available on the website. In addition, there are many recipes, I'll show you some examples there, shopping lists, suggestions for children, and tips to practice this at home, at work, on vacation, and during holidays. And again, many, many other resources on the website. Here's a photographic image of what part of this is. This is just about a half a page of what one of the monthly coupons looks like, maybe one-third or half a page. So we can see here discounts on fruit, fresh vegetables, olive oil, and in the seafood department on this particular coupon. In addition, we developed you've probably seen many different food pyramids and Mediterranean diet pyramids. We've developed a firefighter-specific Mediterranean pyramid, which features, these are actually firefighters from the Indianapolis Fire Department it's hard to see him, but this is actually Chief Malone here at the head of the table. Firefighters exercising, drinking water. We have olive oil figured prominently in the very center of the pyramid, given that it should be a significant portion of calories taken in, and highlighted to use here for all food preparation, cooking, and salad dressings, and using at the table for extra flavor. Fruits and vegetables and other plant substances here at the bottom, lean proteins in the middle, fermented dairy, and then finally the sparing amounts of red meats, hopefully, and sweets. And again, replacing water, replacing sugary beverages and energy drinks with water, very important, as well as physical activity and adequate sleep. We've also come up with a five-step program to try to simplify baby steps for starting a Mediterranean diet. Replacing butter and stick margarine with extra virgin olive oil, eating at least 4 tablespoons a day, drinking water instead of other sugary drinks, choosing lean proteins and limiting red and processed meat, eating more fruits and vegetables, choosing berries instead of, or other fruit instead of sweet desserts, and choosing whole greens and trying to avoid refined carbohydrates. We have a series of 6 videos on the website going over various areas, so basic principles, various, some of the basic health benefits that we've been through, olive oil, nuts, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, etc. And these were all run by a registered dietitian, Heather Fink. Some of you may know her. She's based in Indianapolis and works extensively with this fire department as well as other fire departments. We conducted extensive focus groups with firefighters and their spouses before starting the study, and we came up with, we had each person give us their 5 favorite recipes. We cross-correlated all the recipes, and we came up with commonalities such as chicken dishes or ground meat dishes. And then we teamed up with our scientists, physicians, nutritionists, and even celebrity chefs such as Maria Loy here, who has a famous restaurant in New York. She adapted a lot of her recipes. So you can see this is a nice meatloaf, traditional Greek meatloaf, but instead of ground beef or other red meat, it's using ground turkey and ground chicken. Similarly, we have recipes for ground chicken, ground turkey, chili, hamburgers, and other foods like that. What about the data collection? It's quite extensive, and it's done every 6 months. It includes substantial questionnaires, a questionnaire that we've developed, plus the Harvard Food Frequency Questionnaire, the Modified Mediterranean Diet Score, which we derive from the questionnaire, questions on behavioral readiness, blood pressure, body composition, and then on a yearly basis, one of our partners locally in Indianapolis, the fire department, in conjunction with the union and this clinic, provide a medical examination for the firefighters on a voluntary basis. Again, the main measurement of the study is the Mediterranean Diet Score, Modified Mediterranean Diet Score, that we talked about earlier from the PlusMed study, and incorporates all of the basic elements of the Mediterranean diet, as well as some negative scores for things such as fried food, fast food, and sweets and desserts. So now quickly looking at some of the preliminary results. This is a summary slide here. It's a bit hard to read, but there were, I'm going to break it down for you in a moment. We're looking at the intervention group versus the control group. We also compared each group compared to their baseline. But what we see here was a significant increase in scores from baseline in the modified Mediterranean diet score for the intervention group, no such change for the control group, and a significant difference comparing the intervention to the control for the overall score. And then we had differences on multiple individual scores. I'm going to show you on the following slides because it's going to be easier for you to appreciate. So first, looking at each group compared to its own baseline. For the intervention group, summarizing, we saw a median increase in the modified Mediterranean diet score of more than 10%. This is about what is compatible with what was seen in the PREDIMED study in terms of the PREDIMED scores. And this was highly significant. We also saw statistically significant differences for individual components such as increased fruit, olive oil, nuts, and greater consumption of unrefined or whole grains. We saw decreases in the consumption of fried foods and refined starches, and again, both of those were statistically significant. In the control group, we saw, again, no significant change in the modified Mediterranean diet score. In terms of individual food components, we did see a significant increase in the use of olive oil and other better quality olive oils at the fire station, but not at home, and not an increase in overall olive oil consumption, and no significant changes in any other food score. Now the true mark of a control trial is where we compare the intervention group to the control group, again, not based on compliance with the diet, but simply based on head-to-head comparison. And we see here, compared to the control group, the increase in the modified Mediterranean diet score was not only was it increased, but the increase was significantly greater than that observed in the controls. Nut consumption was significantly greater increase than that seen in the controls, as well as extra virgin olive oil. So really the overall score plus the healthy fats here, we think very important, boding well for looking at the rest of the study. Right now we're hard at work analyzing 12-month data and in the next week or so collecting 18-month data. I just want to show you quickly that in parallel to the study with career firefighters, we have a open access, uncontrolled trial for volunteer firefighters because they make up about 70% of the fire service. And this is something in conjunction with the National Volunteer Fire Council, open to any volunteer firefighter who wishes to go to the website and sign the online consent. And among those volunteer firefighters or spouses who have completed a 3-month follow-up, we saw, again, statistically significant increases after the intervention in the mean Mediterranean diet, modified Mediterranean diet score, and significant increases in individual component changes for home oil use, less fried foods, greater consumption of fish, better quality of home and beverages at work as well. In trying to promote this movement among the firefighters nationally, we partnered with Firehouse Kitchen, FHK Firehouse Kitchen. This is Ray Cooney, who is the host of Firehouse Kitchen. This is Lieutenant Mike Cacciola, retired from the Fire Department in New York, and that's myself. And we cooked for one of the intervention houses here, and Ray recorded 2 episodes of the show, also in conjunction with a cancer summit that the firefighters held around cancer prevention. And these episodes will air in syndication and also on social media this month, now in June. And we hope to distribute those widely among the fire service. And Ray is also very enthusiastic about this. Ray has promised to go on the Mediterranean diet himself, and we have agreed to collaborate on more shows. Some of the other studies we're doing, sub-studies within the overall protocol, we're looking at biomarkers of olive oil consumption in urine, tyrosol, and hydroxytyrosol. Those results are pending. We're looking at plasma fatty acid profiles based on intervention status and based on compliance with the diet. We've also taken stool samples in both the intervention and control groups, and we'll be repeating these and the biomarker measures in a couple months. These will help us look at the effect of the diet on the microbiome. And we also plan to do studies looking at safe serum, looking at metabolomics, looking at the metabolic profiles based on, again, intervention status and compliance with the diet. One of our parallel efforts is to generalize this to other public safety workers. And here we've created a Mediterranean diet pyramid for law enforcement and police. And we're currently discussing this with some law enforcement sources to see if we can roll this out as an intervention trial more widely among police. And lastly, a study that we're doing in conjunction with Spanish investigators at the auto manufacturer SEAT. So although it's a Mediterranean country, as you know, probably many countries in the Mediterranean have gone away from their traditional diet, and SEAT is doing a head-to-head study between two of their plants with a Mediterranean diet nutritional intervention. So more on that to come in the future. So at that point, I'm going to stop and give it back to our moderator and entertain any questions that we have time for. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Kales. We have a few questions that have come in. The first one is there a means to measure individual use of the website or views of the video?
That's a great question. We don't have a means at this time to measure individual use. We have strong website support from the university's IT crew, but we're also a bit, let's say, constrained that we have to use the existing platform. So we don't, at this point, we don't have a specific way to look at web traffic. We are working with Kroger to look at the utilization of those coupons. So, I mean, not answering that question directly, but we are interested in those types of things.
Okay. And the second question is, want to know about the physical exam. Does it include blood pressure or a lipid panel?
Yes, the medical examination includes blood pressure, body composition, various exercise tests such as push-up capacity, exercise tolerance tests, and then routine blood tests including blood glucose, lipid panel, and CRP.
And then do these firefighters eat food prepared communally while on duty? And the second part of this question is, what percentage of weekly meals are eaten while on duty?
Yeah, great question. So, yes, they certainly do eat communally when they're at work. And that's roughly, usually they do 2 to 3 24-hour shifts per week. So if you take it like 2.5 days and 3 meals per day, you know, it comes out to somewhere between 6 and 8 meals typically at the fire station on a weekly basis out of, you know, maybe 21. And that was also a big idea with doing the Firehouse Kitchen episodes, was not just to go there to a fire station and cook with them, but also to create a medium that we could show at multiple fire stations and to multiple firefighters. And in a couple weeks, I'm headed out with Chef Malay, who you saw one of her recipes, and we're going to be cooking at another fire station and also an event open to the public and firefighter spouses. So if anyone's in Indianapolis, they might look for an event. I believe it's on the 21st at Kroger Supermarket in Carmel.
Okay, and this question is regarding sort of the control and intervention. Do firefighters frequently move between units as part of their work assignments? So could there be a chance that might have been contamination, you know, in terms of the randomization?
Yeah, we have a really smart audience. So that's an excellent question. And movement is limited. But it does exist, and we are tracking that carefully. And it has not been great, but there have been some situations. And I'm sure we have contamination just because the firefighters talk with each other. During the first 12 months, we had the website as being password restricted. Now, after the first 12 months, the control group has shifted over into receiving the intervention because we wanted to make it available to everyone. So that password has been removed, but we have been tracking anyone who moved, and we're looking, you know, in secondary analyses, we may look at specific houses to see if there were three or four people that moved one way or the other, if that could have affected things at a specific house. But great, great question.
Okay, we have one final question here. How was the main education delivered to the firefighters? Was it through the website, the handouts? You did mention that not many attended the group classes.
Yeah, I would say the major sources of education were the handouts and the website. And again, we can't, unfortunately, we can't track except by maybe doing a post hoc survey and focus groups and that sort of thing. You know, what they preferred the most and what were the best. But when we tried to have group sessions with the nutritionist, although some people specifically requested that, then on an overall basis, the attendance was kind of low. I think it makes sense with, you know, the way people are active and they're just like all of us. I mean, they're shuttling their kids to different activities, and most of them are, you know, two income families, et cetera. So access to videos on a website is probably the easiest way.
Okay, well, that's all the questions. I see that we're about out of time.
Great. Well, thank you again today to Dr. Kales, and thank you to Dan for serving as our moderator today. A few reminders before I close out today's session. So there'll be a short survey at the conclusion of today's webinar. Please do take a moment to complete that. Again, watch for an email on Tuesday that should include today's recording, the handout for today, and your CEU certificate. And then just be sure to be on the lookout for any additional webinars that may be coming up. Thank you so much, and everybody have a great day.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. If I could just mention the event happening later this month at Yale University. It's a great conference. I've participated, and you see it here on the screen. You can go to the MDR website, but Rachel was going to mention that. I think if people are interested in the Mediterranean diet and learning more, it's an annual event and a nice thing to attend.
Thank you.